All right, so this morning, we will begin an eight-part uninterrupted series on one of the shortest books of the New Testament. It's so short that it only has one chapter, 25 verses, and though short, however, it can be rather intimidating, and I would bet that you've never heard any popular radio or TV preacher give any sermon from it. And along that line, it's not the type of book that you would be eager to tackle in, say, a home group, where everyone is invited to offer up their own input and thoughts. All of this because it contains a number of oddities and strange references that make it quite challenging to navigate. And I am, of course, talking about the book of Jude. And that small letter at the end of the New Testament, right before Revelation, in fact, one kind of gets the impression that no one knew where to place it in the Bible, so they just stuck it there. Now, those who have been here for a while, we'll remember that I did a series on this short letter some time ago, back in 2012, that'd be 13 years ago. So you might ask, well, why are we doing it again? Well, there's some obvious reasons, several reasons, besides the fact that I get to borrow material that I had once worked on. but first, I've had a couple members actually ask me to do this, and being the people pleaser that I am, I just cannot say no to them. Secondly, the material that Denny has been covering in his class actually sets things up for this study. It appears that Jude draws on literature from the intertestament period, and so this seems to be a great way to show the relevance of what his class covered. Thirdly, unless everyone has a photographic memory, I'm assuming that most of what we've covered back then has largely been forgotten. I forgot a lot of it. In fact, I spent many hours on those sermons back then, and just a few months ago, I was trying to recall the point being made in verses 8 through 10, and I could not remember any of it. And so we might just think of this as kind of like a refresher course. And along that line, we do have a number of newer folks who have probably never been through a study of Jude, not to mention those who 13 years ago would have just been children in the Sunday school and who are now out with us. So we have a, kind of like a different crowd. And finally, and this is the most important, the warnings and exhortations in this small letter, they're quite relevant to us. They are always relevant as individuals and as a church, and they are worth revisiting from time to time. And so my plan is to take what was presented back in 2012, redo it, rework it, make some needed improvements, which I've been doing, and clean things up. So this will be Jude 2.0, if you will. So this is actually a fun book for me. There are a number of strange references that require some work to figure out, but all that makes it quite interesting, thought-provoking, even fun. If after I retire, I were ever asked to fill in at another church for several weeks, Jude would be on my short list of what to do there, because I really like this book. Now, for the past 2 or 3 months, I've been preparing for the series by reading through it many times, using a variety of different translations and versions, and this is a standard routine for me whenever I'm preparing to take us through a book in the Bible, and you've heard me talk about this before. And it's a practice that I would recommend for everyone, regardless of the book that you might be reading. We tend to pick things up that have escaped our attention if we're just reading out of the same translation over and over. And here's a good example, and there are many, but here's a good one. In verse 4, the author is warning his readers about fake believers infiltrating their church, spreading false teachings. So the NIV reads, "have secretly slipped in among you." All right, accurate, descriptive, but rather matter of fact. The Christian Standard Bible has "have come in by stealth," a bit more colorful. The ESV "have crept in unnoticed." Okay, that certainly leaves an impression. The CEV "have sneaked in." All right, that's colorful. The Phillips, see if I can pronounce this correctly, have surreptitiously entered the church, all right? I think that's the first time I've ever used that word or ever saw that word, and it just means to avoid being noticed. And the NLT have wormed their way into your church, and so all of them convey the same meaning, but some seem to highlight the point more vividly wormed their way in, I think, is much more impressionable and is therefore the one that I'm most likely to remember. So in this series, I'd like for us to read through Jude at least once a week, a pretty easy thing to do. And as you do, read from different versions. There's no shortage of them. They are all they're all widely available on the internet. And that said, however, the version that I'll be drawing from the most will be the ESV. Some from the NIV, but mostly from the ESV. So the gist of the letter is basically this, to kind of start things off. We have these fake believers who have crept into this particular church, intruders, and they are promoting sexual immorality and other godless behaviors, claiming that such freedoms are afforded Christians because of God's grace. Essentially, they are exploiting God's willingness to forgive, turning all that into a license to sin. And we see this today quite a bit. And these infiltrators are commonly referred to as false teachers. And that would be accurate because they are teaching false doctrines, but Jude doesn't actually call them that in this letter. Generally speaking, we tend to think of a false teacher as someone who is leading a group, like a cult, or has assumed a position of authority in a church, like a pastor, and is teaching heresy from the pulpit. But in this case, these false teachers appear to be more like rank and file members of this local congregation. They are influencing other believers, but it's not like they have taken over the church. Rather, they have blended in. However, Jude is quite troubled by them, by their teachings, and considers them to be a serious threat. And so in this series, I will be referring to them mostly as infiltrators or fake believers or possibly from time to time false teachers. Jude's title for them is actually there in verse 4, ungodly people. And later in the letter, he has other names for them. He refers to them as grumblers, malcontents, loudmouth boasters, and scoffers, and more. But most of the time, it is ungodly people or ungodly sinners that he refers to them as. The word itself, ungodly, or some form of it, is found no less than 6 times in this short letter. So as a way to prepare for the study, I thought it would be helpful to lay out some of the more obvious oddities and challenges that we will be facing. All right, there we go. These are the things that you might say scare people away from the book, and there are a number of them. First, Jude quotes a prophecy that is attributed to a figure way back, into the first chapters of Genesis, even before the great flood. Enoch, the 7th from Adam, father of Methuselah. Enoch, who walked with God and was taken into heaven, who did not die. How many remember him? Okay, should. Now, real quick here, there are different ways to pronounce his name. Enoch is the way that I grew up hearing it. Josh tells me that in Hebrew it would be Enoch. Okay, I think I did that right. And I've heard other people refer to him as Enoch, but that sounds more like an Amish grandfather. So I'm sticking with Enoch, and I checked it out on the internet, and the internet affirmed it. And the internet, as you know, never lies, right? But the question is, really, to get serious here, where did Jude get this prophecy that he attributes to Enoch? And that's actually a big deal here. A common answer to that is, well, from the book of Enoch. And there was a popular writing in Jude's day, especially in Jewish circles, called the Book of Enoch, that contains this prophecy word for word. And so where did this book come from? Did Enoch actually write it? If so, why is it not included in the Bible? If Enoch did not write it, then why is Jude quoting from it? And he quotes this ancient prophecy as though it is an actual prophecy of God, inspired, reliable, and authoritative. And so we have to figure some of this out, and it can be a little tricky. Secondly, Jude refers to an argument between Michael the archangel and the devil. There's nothing in the Old Testament about any of this, but yet Jude speaks of it as an actual event, something that really did occur. And so where did he get this from? Well, it appears that this story came from another book that was popular during his time, a book where only fragments of it have survived to our day, something called the Testament of Moses, sometimes referred to as the Assumption of Moses. And this raises, of course, all kinds of questions. What is this Testament of Moses? Is it a lost book of the Bible? Is it reliable? Why is Jude quoting from it? And why are Michael and the devil arguing about the body of Moses? What is all this about? So this will be fun to explore as well. Another problem also found in that passage is this warning to not blaspheme or slander celestial beings. And Jude illustrates this with the fact that Michael refused to pronounce a blasphemous judgment against even the devil. And understanding the application here can be a little tricky. After all, I doubt many of us struggle daily with this temptation to curse angelic beings, all right? I just lack so much self-control in this area, this bad habit of slandering the glorious ones, as it says in verse 8. Anyone struggle with that sort of thing? I don't think I ever have. So what's the application here? There's got to be an application. What exactly were these false teachers doing that was so troublesome? And then we have this business about the angels from long ago forsaking their designated positions of authority, leaving their proper dwelling. So what is Jude referring to here? And he goes on to compare them to the homosexuals in Sodom and Gomorrah. And there are many questions. A common interpretation is that Jude is referring to the situation back in Genesis 6, an obscure and controversial passage where some read into it that angels left their abode in heaven, came to earth, and married human women. And the parallel that is often drawn is that both these angels and the homosexuals of Sodom and Gomorrah engaged in forbidden sexual relationships. They united themselves to what the King James refers to in verse 7 as strange flesh, literally different flesh, that is, bodies they were not intended for. This is a popular view, especially among amateur students of the Bible, but there are a number of problems with it. This whole business of angels engaging in sexual activity and with humans raises, you know, a lot of serious issues, and all this warrants careful examination, which we will do. Number five, we also have a somewhat curious situation where a good chunk of Jude's letter is repeated almost verbatim in the second chapter of 2 Peter. And so why is that? What's the relationship between these two books? Who copied who? And where there are differences, why are there differences? And resolving this can get quite involved, but it will not be that hard for us. Virtually all scholars believe that Jude was written first, and so the question is more of one that pertains to the study of 2 Peter. Why did Peter copy from Jude? Which means I don't have to address it in this series, all right? It can wait until we do a study of 2 Peter, and I will leave that for someone else. I think Tim was volunteering for that, if I remember. Right, Tim? Yeah? I thought I saw that somewhere. All right. Another thing that can be a bit peculiar or odd is the solution Jude offers up to the problem he keeps hammering on. This isn't something I found addressed in any of the commentaries I looked at, and so I might be alone in this, but it's something I definitely notice and just find it to be a little strange. Jude spends most of his letter railing against these false teachers who have wormed their way into this particular church. He exposes their wicked intentions, warning the believers of the destruction that they will bring. He's quite harsh in his assessment of them. And so I would have expected some sort of run them out of the town with pitchforks, you know, kind of response there in the final paragraphs. You know, throw them out of the church. Don't ever let them back in. Don't mess around. Do it now. And while that may still be a right response, the instructions in this letter go actually in a different direction. Instead of focusing on ridding the church of these teachers, he calls on the faithful to remain steadfast. He exhorts them to be mature and stable, to persevere and remain strong in the Lord. A worthy exhortation indeed, but it wasn't exactly what you might be expecting when reading the letter, at least for the first time through. And finally, number seven here is the way Jude uses typology as prophecy. And I'll explain this more when we get into those sections. But basically, he takes someone from the past, someone like Cain, for instance, or Korah, or the residents of Sodom and Gomorrah, and presents them as foreshadows or types of these infiltrators that they need to be warned about. And it's a method that's fairly unique to Jude, not exclusively, but pretty much. And he sees certain events in Old Testament history as foreshadows and thus prophecies about events in the end times, which he then applies to these false teachers in his own day. And so that's something we want to look at as well. So because this book contains a number of these sorts of peculiarities and challenges, a careful and conservative approach here would be warranted. I mean, quite frankly, wannabe Bible teachers who are drawn to the sensational and are reckless with hermeneutics could do a great deal of damage with a book like Jude. And so a responsible, measured approach is going to be essential here. Thus, I will be relying heavily on the experts, New Testament scholars who have devoted a lot of their time and energy in carefully working through this book. And I'm not going to be offering up anything new or novel to the discussion. Everything's going to be carefully checked out. And when I see all the experts agree on something, you know, I'm going with it. If there isn't a general consensus on something, then I'll present the various opinions and lay out the arguments for and against. So here's a partial list of those sources. Along the way, expect me to say something like this. I'll probably be saying it a lot. Here is what we know. Here is what we think we know, things we can safely assume, things that make sense and fit in with what we know. And here is what we don't know. And there will be some areas in Jude where we will have to be content to say, we don't know. So to help set things up, I thought it might be helpful to share some various comments about Jude from a few of these experts, and it may give us a good feel of what lies before us in this series. Philip Towner, however brief, harsh, and puzzling the letter of Jude can seem to be as it describes the dangers facing its first audience of believers, and what was ultimately at stake for them, it does not fail to find in these dangers the opportunity and responsibility to go forward in mercy with reconciliation and peace as the goal. The troubles and stress experienced by those early Christian communities may seem foreign to us, and if they don't, some of Jude's methods of communication will. Very true. Thomas Manton, this is back in the middle 1600s, wrote this, his letter, though brief, is weighty and has in it some magnificent utterances on standing firm for Jesus Christ in the face of apostasy and immorality within the churches. It is not a letter to be overlooked. Peter Davids, Jude is a book that has often been treated with benign neglect, rarely the text for a sermon. Even in the university or seminary classroom, it is often given only brief treatment at the end of a course on general epistles, perhaps as part of the last lecture on the final day of the course. Edward Blum, the book of Jude has been called the most neglected book in the New Testament. There may be various reasons for its neglect, such as its brevity, its citation of non-canonical Jewish writings, and its burning denunciation of error. Yet Christians and the church today need to listen to Jude's contribution to biblical revelation. The emphasis on a fixed core of truth known as the faith needs to be pondered. Donald Guthrie, perhaps more than any other New Testament book, the Epistle of Jude is assumed to have little or no permanent value and is therefore virtually excluded from the practical, as distinct from the formal, canon of the many sections of the church. So what does he mean by that? It's an interesting statement. So he continues, if the examples Jude cites for his own day, Israelites, Sodom and Gomorrah, Cain, Balaam, Korah, had relevance then, his whole epistle must have relevance now, unless the nature of divine justice and the character of human lasciviousness and kindred evils has changed. As long as men need stern rebukes for their practices, the epistle of Jude will remain relevant. Its neglect reflects more the superficiality of the generation that neglects it than the irrelevance of its burning message. Well put. And of course, one of our favorite scholars, D.A. Carson, this letter is a strong challenge to its readers to oppose resolutely all teachers and habits of life that profess to be Christian but deny the essence of the faith. The letter speaks to the modern world as to every previous age. In our century, it is the fashion to be tolerant of anything that calls itself Christian. Jude reminds us that there are limits. The modern church must realize that it is possible to fashion the gospel so radically that the heart of it is taken out of it. It is possible to reinterpret the Christian life so that it ceases to be too demanding and degenerates into a way of living indistinguishable from that of the world. In the face of such attitudes, Jude's warnings are of continuing significance. Is this helpful? Getting a feel for it? How many are scared of Jude? How many are looking forward to this? Right? Good. Richard Bachman, the style is lively and vigorous, and the whole work gives evidence of careful composition. Close exegesis soon reveals great economy of expression. Single words, phrases, and images are chosen for the association they carry, and scripture allusions and catchword connections increase the depth of meaning. Stephen Krafchik, the letter is filled with strange language and obscure references. It is polemical and uncompromising, and its author appears to satirize, and disparage his opponents rather than engaging their thought and teaching. Moreover, the author's own thoughts are embedded in his polemic, and even a sympathetic reader must work hard at uncovering them. All right, so polemic just simply means that of expressing a strong critical attack on a or a controversial opinion on something or someone. All right, and then Leland Ryken, the author writes in the white heat of anger as he attacks his opponents more vehemently than anything else we find in the New Testament, except for Jesus' denunciation of the Jewish leaders in Matthew 23. And then there is this, I love the subtitle here, to Maxwell's Cotter's commentary on Jude, The Acts of the Apostates. And I bought it just because of that title. That was really intriguing. So Cotter offers these words in his introduction. Jude brings his teachings of the entire Bible about apostasy to a tremendous climax. He takes us back to the very dawn of human history. We are reminded of apostasy at the gate of Eden and within God's ancient people, Israel. Our thoughts are turned to princes and prophets, to saints and sinners, to eternal fire and everlasting darkness, to the sea and to the stars, to past judgments and future glory. And he continues, we are taken into the unseen world for a strange and terrible story of the sin of fallen angels and another story of dispute between Michael, the archangel, and Satan, those antagonists who are set over against each other once more in mortal combat in Revelation 12. And then a couple paragraphs later, he asks, why should such a rich storehouse of Bible truth have been so seriously neglected? So a wide range of comments, but as you can tell, they all share in common a certain perspective about Jude's letter, and this is kind of helpful to get a feel for. You know, it says some difficult and strange things or puzzling things here in Jude. It contains harsh language condemning heretics. It is a neglected book that Christians need to read, and it is relevant for churches and believers today. So let's now turn our attention to how the letter is structured. Getting a good handle on the author's flow of thought will be very helpful in this, and your own Bible will probably show an outline similar to the one here behind me on the wall. You have a greeting in the first couple verses, followed by a reason for writing the letter, what we call the occasion. Then we have a warning against these infiltrators, which consists of the bulk of the letter. And then we have a short call to persevere and grow toward the end, and then a closing doxology in the last two verses. And this four-part outline, it's easy to remember, it's also easy to recognize from the text itself. And here actually is the complete letter broken down into those parts, and I think you can read all that, right? So when you look at this, one might think that the main focus of the letter is the condemnation of these infiltrators, these false teachers. It's the largest block of material, which runs all the way from verse 5 to 19. And this, of course, would be a natural assumption, given that it occupies a good three-fourths of this short letter. However, upon a closer look, and by actually following Jude's train of thought, you'll see that the whole section here, this warning and judgment concerning these fake believers and their heresies, is simply leading everything up to the main point itself, which we find in verses 20 and 23. This is where we find the actual call to action and the purpose of Jude's writing. Those final verses are not, as many people tend to think, just kind of like a closing exhortation. And recognizing that this is the heart of it is, of course, a vital key to understanding the book as a whole. And while we're at it, one more thing regarding Jude's structure, and it deals with this large section here, is that we find an interesting pattern which goes something like this. There is a citation of a historical event, something in the past that the readers would be familiar with. This then is followed with an explanation of how that event foreshadows the wicked and ungodly intentions of these fake believers. And this pattern is then repeated and repeated again and repeated again and again for a total of five times. And we have here five specific indictments or condemnations. So, citation of a type, and then the fulfillment of that type, and the type then functions as a prophecy that's being fulfilled before them. One of the more noticeable stylistic characteristics that helps us to highlight this pattern is Jude's repeated use of these people. It is his way of transitioning from one indictment to the next when you see that. So let's project this here on the screen and see it firsthand, and you might, if you want, follow along in your own Bibles. Starting in verse 5, we have Jude referring to three different events in the Old Testament. The Israelites, who after being delivered from Egypt, refused to believe God and were destroyed. And then angels, who did not stay within their own position of authority, but left their proper dwellings and are now kept in eternal chains under gloomy darkness. And Sodom and Gomorrah and the surrounding cities were destroyed by fire for indulging in sexual immorality. And now the fulfillment or application in verse 8. Yet in like manner, these people, these infiltrators, also relying on their dreams, defile the flesh, reject authority, and blaspheme the glorious ones. Okay, next one. In verse 9, we find a reference to the archangel Michael contending with the devil. And in this heated exchange, Michael did not overstep his authority by pronouncing a blasphemous judgment against the devil. And this is followed by how that applies to these teachers. But these people, that is, in contrast, blaspheme all that they do not understand, and they are destroyed by all that they, like unreasoning animals, understand instinctively. The third one, verse 11, Jude refers to something in history, in this case, three Old Testament figures, each representing a particular aspect of ungodliness, Cain, Balaam, and Korah. And this is followed by the fulfillment of that prophecy or type in the next verse. These people are hidden reefs at your love feast, as they feast with you without fear, shepherds feeding themselves, waterless clouds swept along by winds, fruitless trees in late autumn, twice dead, uprooted, wild waves of the sea, casting up their foam for their own shame, wandering stars for whom the gloom of utter darkness has been reserved forever. The fourth one is found in verses 14 to 15, the prophecy of Enoch, the Lord and his army of thousands coming to execute judgment on ungodly sinners. And this prophecy will ultimately be fulfilled on the day of judgment. But it is also fulfilled partially by Jude's condemnation of these infiltrators. These people are grumblers, malcontents, following their own sinful desires. They are loudmouth boasters, showing favoritism to gain advantage. And now the last one, verse 17. We have a reference to something in the past, in this case, the prediction of the apostles, that wolves in sheep's clothing are to be expected. And this then is the fulfillment or application of that. It is these people, those spreading heresies in your church, who cause divisions. They are worldly people devoid of the Spirit. So this particular pattern we see in this whole section is not only interesting, but it's also quite helpful as we follow along in this study. So next Sunday, we're going to be spending some time on more of the background to this book, especially the who, what, when, where, and why all essential. And between now and then, I just would encourage you to do two things, if you would. Read through the book at least once. Maybe do that on Saturday night, so it's fresh in your mind. And do this each week using different translations. And secondly, this is going to be tough, but I'm just going to ask it as politely as I can. Refrain from using your influence in the church to spread heretical ideas, okay? Because I would hate to use you as an example of what Jude is addressing in this book, all right? But I would. All right, let's stand. I'm going to have the musicians come at this time.